This is the Kathleen Dunn Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen today. Kathleen will be back tomorrow. Our 1 o'clock hour on Monday is devoted to a discussion of all things political. So what political story caught your attention this past week? Was it the prospect of Paul Ryan becoming Speaker of the House? Ben Carson overtaking Donald Trump in Iowa? The Jeb Bush campaign staff shakeup? Hillary Clinton's appearance before the Benghazi committee? Or was it some other piece of political news? Perhaps it was health care. October is open enrollment month, a time when many of us make decisions about health care coverage, so perhaps you have a political take on that. Well, here's the toll-free number to call to join the program today. I'll give it off the top of the show because it's a different number from the one we usually have. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Of course, you can also post a comment or question on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page or send an email to talk@wpr.org. My guest is Yevgeny Feyman, fellow with and deputy director of the Manhattan Institute Center for Medical Progress. He writes on healthcare policy, entitlement reform, and the Affordable Care Act. Yevgeny Feyman, welcome back to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the House of Representatives. Paul Ryan has apparently agreed to run for Speaker, the caveat being that he needs his family time. Assuming that he is actually elected, what does he need to do to succeed where John Boehner did not?
Well, he's going to have to walk a really, really thin line between both honoring promises to do things like reduce spending and make government more accountable, while I think broadly getting some kind of consensus of the various GOP factions, for instance, to actually get a clean debt limit vote before the deadline is up. That's why one of his preconditions was that he basically have the support of the Freedom Caucus, because they would be the ones primarily opposing him.
Well, I mean, and they pretty much said that they're not at home to compromise of any sort, and they appear to feel like they've got the hammer hand.
Yeah, you know, it's going to be very difficult. In their initial message, they said they were able to pick up, I don't remember, 60 or 70% of the support, not enough to actually outright endorse him. It's possible that you'll see some defection there, that they won't vote completely within their own party line. But there's a reason why Paul Ryan said that he's not really interested in this job. He doesn't want it. That's why he's in a place to make these demands. John Boehner has had a really, really tough time navigating these waters, and it doesn't seem like it's going to be getting any easier this time around.
Well, I mean, some people have suggested that taking the job of Speaker of the House of Representatives in its current form is a pretty much political suicide for anybody who does it. I mean, that seems a little extreme, but it doesn't look like it's a job that anybody with political aspirations beyond the House of Representatives would want to get within 1,000 miles of. Why? What's Paul Ryan's incentive for actually taking this on?
I think really for Paul Ryan, it's because everyone's pretty much asking him to do it. So there's some sense that people view him as a moderating voice, but a moderating voice that can unite the party a little bit. So the fact that even among the Freedom Caucus he was able to generate some support is a good sign. And I think for him, he's probably thinking, if he can do this successfully, I think success would be measured in part by whether or not he really gets his demands met. If he can do this successfully, he sets himself up for a terrific potential presidential run again, or a vice presidential run. If he does this well, it certainly helps with his future political career. And I think he's willing to take the risk so long as he can control it.
Now he's insisting that there be some work life balance in this job. The left, of course, critical of his demand for same, when according to them his policies are against things like paid family leave, affordable child care, a higher minimum wage, and so forth. Are those criticisms fair? I mean, why should he be calling for work-life balance if he's going to vote against it for others?
Well, you know, one can support particular goals without believing that government should have something to do with it. So, you know, I support universal health care, but I believe that government's role in doing so should be relatively minimal. I'm sure there's many conservatives out there who believe that companies should pay a wage that can support someone's someone's bare necessities, lifestyle, without believing that a minimum wage is the way to do so. So I don't think those criticisms are really fair because they don't get to the distinction between what you believe government's role is versus what your personal priorities are.
How important, really important, is it for the Republican Party to prove that it can actually govern? Because they haven't been able to really agree on much of anything over the past few years. And we have the prospect now of showdowns over the debt ceiling again, the transportation bill, Planned Parenthood funding. How important is it for the GOP to prove that with the majority they can actually govern?
Very important. You know, like you said, the past few years haven't been great for the GOP's image as actual agents of the government, as actually being able to manage their responsibilities, and you know that's hurt them. Over all these arguments, all these debates over the debt ceiling, the sequester, Republicans have taken the brunt of the negative publicity rather than the administration or the Democrats. So I think right now both Republicans and Democrats are very skeptical of the GOP's ability to govern. And ironically, I think on the GOP side, on the Republican side, as a result, they've moved towards a candidate who's relatively extreme. I think that's what's helping spur Donald Trump's support among GOP voters. This idea that he would be able to govern where the GOP isn't.
Well, let's talk about healthcare for a moment, because I know that's your real area of expertise, and you've spent a long time looking at policy and so forth. October is the month when Americans with or without health insurance, either they have it or they want to enroll in it, need to make decisions about their coverage. This is open enrollment time. And, of course, one of the items in last week's news concerned premiums for health insurance policies across the country. They're going up again, and so are copays and deductibles. Insurance becoming more expensive. One of the things we thought was going to happen when we got more people into the insurance pool was that premiums would actually go down. Jenny Fehman, why are premiums going up, and what do we need to do to get a handle on healthcare costs?
Well, I think for first, it's important to point out that pretty much no health economist really believed that premiums would fall. You know, there certainly was a promise made that we'd see 2,500 average savings in premiums for a typical family. You know, that promise was debunked time and time again. You know, the nature of really costs in any market is over time. They increase, they move with inflation. So inflation has this upward trajectory, and we kind of accept that. That's fine. The problem among healthcare costs is that they grow faster than inflation. So for a little while, we saw this slowdown in healthcare costs, and that's why some people did believe that we might see either a permanent slowdown or even some negative growth in healthcare costs. But they're coming back. Healthcare inflation is on the rise again, especially relative to overall inflation. And really, it's healthcare costs that drive premiums in the insurance market. Insurers' profit margins are relatively small, on average, between 4 and 5%. So that means that for the most part, what's driving those costs that individuals pay are going to be the underlying costs of care. For this particular year, in 2014, what we saw is that drug spending did push costs up. There were some new drugs introduced into the market that are very expensive, and that helped drive a big chunk of the cost increase.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we've seen a lot of news in recent months about huge increases in the cost of some generic or formula drugs as investment companies acquire the rights to certain patents and so forth. We've certainly seen that, but there's got to be a lot more to it. What at the end of the day, besides drug costs, what are the real cost drivers? Is it just that we're not very healthy as a society? What is it? We need more health care, therefore it costs more. What's really driving this?
There's a lot of really complicated dynamics going on. Some of the biggest drivers of costs are really hospitals. There are big hospital monopolies in many parts of the countries. And while with pharmaceuticals, with drugs, you'll have a drug that's on patent for 20 years and then goes off patent, you get generics. And for the most part, generics tend to be very, very low cost. There's some exceptions. With hospitals, the cost of an MRI never goes generic. So hospital costs also tend to constantly trend upward, and they make up around 30% of total healthcare spending. Mergers among insurers, and that's kind of what's going on now. That's what the FTC is looking at now. Also have the potential to drive up costs. So insurance markets overall are relatively non-competitive. They're a little more competitive than hospital markets, but those insurance markets becoming less competitive can also put upward pressure on costs. In terms of individuals' health, that definitely plays into it, but predominantly our demand for healthcare services is also influenced by the type of health insurance policies we have. This is where employer-sponsored coverage comes into the picture. The fact that we do have relatively expansive policies that cover many things up front with no cost sharing also helps to drive up total spending.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Yevgeny Feyman here on All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Kathleen will be back tomorrow. We invite your participation this afternoon, as always, 800-642-1234. That's a different number than the one you're used to calling for this program, 800-642-1234. You can also post to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Leave your comment or question there. Or you can join us via email. The address is talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call. We'll start in Madison, and Dave is there. Dave, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I actually have two questions. First is you talked about the increase in health insurance costs. I remember that the people who were opposed to Obamacare said it would raise them 20%. But I haven't heard what you said the actual increase was. My second question is, we've got a set of states that didn't buy into Obamacare, and then we've got a bunch of states that did buy into Obamacare. Whose health insurance costs are rising faster?
Dave, thanks for the question. You have Jenny Feynman?
When you talk about how health insurance costs are increasing, you've got to specify really which market you're talking about. So we have primarily two different markets. In the private sector, we have the employer-sponsored market and we have the individual market. The employer-sponsored market functions separately from the individual market. Companies pool risk differently there. And based on the most recent numbers, costs there have increased somewhere around 4 or 5%, the actual increase in premiums for 2015 relative to 2014. That's a relatively low increase, but it is an increasing increase over what we've seen before, which is why we're starting to say that the slowdown is probably over. In the individual market, which is where Obamacare, the ACA, made a lot of its changes, things are a little bit different. There it varies tremendously by state, sometimes even by county. Some places have seen decreases in costs on the order of 1 or 2%. Others have seen double-digit increases, 15, sometimes even 20%. It's difficult to get a full sense of what the average increase is. My best guess among the individual market, it's probably high single digits, 8-9%. It's important to note when you talk about the effect of Obamacare on the cost of insurance, much of the effect would have happened in the first year from 2013 to 2014 because that's when a lot of the new requirements for insurance coverage went into effect. And I've conducted a study, as have others, that have found that increases in that year ranged anywhere from 20-25% to sometimes 40-45%. It really varies by market and by what age group you're looking at. To the second part of your question, when you're looking at different states and how receptive they were to Obamacare, there's really no such thing as quote-unquote buying in or not buying into Obamacare. You can talk about the Medicaid expansion. A lot of states haven't engaged in the Medicaid expansion. But really, when it comes to Obamacare, you either set up your exchange or the feds do it for you. So there are states that have been less supportive of the law, and in those states, the insurance commissioners haven't been as willing to push down on insurance companies and try to get them to lower rates. It's kind of hard to categorize necessarily which states are and aren't receptive to Obamacare. You could try to do it along Republican and Democratic lines, but the problem is there, Democrat states, blue states tend to also have healthier populations. So it's not clear what the effect of opposing Obamacare actually has on insurance costs in the state.
Hmm. It's all things political today on the Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll take more of your calls and continue our conversation with Yevgeny Fayman in just a moment. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back. And when we come back, I want to move on to presidential politics because that was really the big political news of the last few days. Still to come, we'll talk both about Republican and Democrat presidential politics. And also want to touch on Hillary Clinton's appearance before the Benghazi committee and who were the winners and losers in that. So if you want to line up your calls along those topics, that would be great. We're going to move on from healthcare in just a moment. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's all things political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's all things political on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back tomorrow. And my guest is Yevgeny Fayman. He's with us this hour to talk politics and political news. He's also a fellow with and deputy director of the Manhattan Institute's Center for Medical Progress. He writes on healthcare policy, entitlement reform, and the Affordable Care Act. Let's talk a little bit about presidential politics. We'll start with the Republicans. Ben Carson has overtaken Donald Trump in the polls in Iowa. How significant is that? Is Donald Trump on the defensive now?
It's hard to say, really, who's on defensive when. I think it shifts based on what comments which candidate makes at what time. So right now, Ben Carson is picking up some steam, I think, partly because he started to finally expound some policy positions, so that might indicate he's a little bit more on the offensive. I'm not sure that indicates that Trump is necessarily on the defensive. What's important to consider, though, is that these are still really, really early polls, and they're likely not indicative of who's ultimately going to be the nominee. If you actually look at websites like iPredict, where people actually bet on who's likely to be the nominee or the winner of the election, right now Marco Rubio actually leads the Republican nomination probability. So it might be fair to say that Carson right now is on the offensive. We just want to be careful not to put too much emphasis on these really early polls.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ben Carson made some news yesterday by saying he would love to see Roe versus Wade overturned, making abortion illegal nationwide with almost no exemptions. How realistic is this, and how does this help or hurt his candidacy?
It's certainly not realistic at all. It's likely, first of all, that Republicans aren't going to keep the Senate. So it's likely Congress, first of all, going to be divided. Roe v. Wade is a very, very well-established legal principle. By now, it was established based on the right to privacy more than anything. Even if Congress were to be able to get the political capital and the votes to completely overturn Roe v. Wade, I could imagine a lawsuit immediately after that making it to the Supreme Court. And even with the current makeup of the court, roughly split down the middle between conservative and liberal, with one sort of teetering on the fence, I can't imagine that the court would actually allow Roe v. Wade to be overturned. So I don't think that's realistic. And I think what's happening now is because the candidates are trying so hard to pander to what they perceive to be the GOP base. They're hurting themselves when it comes to the general election. Comments like these, if Carson were to get nominated, would come back and hurt him significantly in a general.
Yeah, it looks like a TV commercial waiting to happen. What about Jeb Bush? I mean, last Friday, his campaign announced staff shakeups, salary cuts, reorganization. This led to speculation that he was getting ready to fold, which he vehemently denied during an appearance in South Carolina. What about the Bush campaign? How viable is it? And again, as you point out, it's so early in the process that speculation is probably not worth the airtime it takes us to discuss it. But here we are. So what about the Bush campaign?
So, I'll go out on a limb and say I don't think the Bush campaign is dead. I think they still have a shot, but certainly 2 months ago I would have given the Bush campaign a better chance than I give them now. I think part of it is Bush has shown to be pretty weak at the debates, at least when it comes to dealing with Trump, and I think that hurt him significantly. We've got another debate coming up soon, and that might be a chance for him to shine a little bit there if he can actually hold out. Now the question is whether fundraisers will want to continue giving him money. That's an open question, and unfortunately, that's one that's pretty hard to speculate on.
And then there's Marco Rubio. You mentioned earlier that he is he's a betting favorite for actually being able to capture the GOP nomination. How palatable is Senator Rubio to the GOP hierarchy, as particularly as an alternative to Ben Carson or Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think. And far be it for me to know what the GOP hierarchy is thinking, but my best guess is that Rubio does represent something like a middle of the ground, similar to Paul Ryan, perhaps someone who can unite the various GOP caucuses, and someone who at least can portray himself as relatively outside of the beltway because of his age, and someone who's led serious policy discussion on areas where the GOP is a little bit weak on, like immigration. I think those are his big advantages. Unfortunately, his age and the fact that he doesn't have nearly as much experience as some of the other candidates might end up hurting him. Again, I mean, as with Ryan, it's a difficult balancing act for Rubio. But I think ultimately on that he's relatively more attractive to the GOP than obviously Trump, probably more than Carson, possibly more than Bush.
What about the Republican base? You see a lot, there's a lot of Sturm und Drang all the time during any kind of a presidential contest, even more so with as many people running as we have now. But Marco Rubio seems to have had a few problems with what we can think of as a Republican base, particularly over immigration. Is that going to be a difficulty for him going forward?
It's not going to be easy because he will be accused of supporting amnesty, of being weak on national security, in terms of how you deal with Mexican immigrants. He's going to be accused of not being serious about conservative reforms to the immigration system. And frankly, I think he's in a good position to defend himself. As far as getting the nomination goes, he's probably going to have to downplay his more moderate views, or at least portray them in a way that lets him still ride on those views in the general. I think if he were to get the nomination, that would be one of his big strengths for the general election, where on the Democratic side, the likely nominees, either Bernie or Hillary, neither of them has that much experience on immigration, and that would make him an appealing choice for some undecided voters. So it's a balancing act between what he says to the GOP right now, which is why I think he's downplaying a little bit, versus what he'd say when it comes to the general.
Of course, the problem that people running from the Senate have is that they have voting records they have to defend, and the votes can often be interpreted a number of ways, as we've seen historically, because context is kind of goes out the window in a 60-second TV commercial. Does that give an edge to people like Donald Trump or Ben Carson, who don't have a public record of votes? Or even government service, is the Republican Party longing for someone outsider enough not to have anything to do with the government, and is that going to be a problem for those like Senator Rubio, who are part of the government?
Well, as I mentioned before, I think right now the overwhelming support for Trump and by extension for Carson comes out of this concern from the GOP base that the GOP hasn't been able to govern, and they for some reason view someone like Trump as more suitable for the position. So I think there's an element of that being outside of the Beltway that makes them a little bit more appealing. I think over time they're going to show that on serious policy issues, they're going to be incapable of articulating very strong but elegant positions. What's typically attractive about these candidates is that they can offer a very simplistic solution, and they don't have to do much to defend it. On the other hand, candidates who have experience in the Beltway, who have voting records to protect, they understand the nuance of policy. They'll still come out with sound bites, but they can at least defend serious policy work that they've undertaken. I think ultimately those more established candidates do have a strength over the supposed outsiders.
Mm-hmm. 800-642-1234. That's a different number than the one you're used to using for the Kathleen Dunn Show. 800-642-1234. Let us know, what do you think if... for those of you who plan to vote in the Republican primary in Wisconsin when we eventually get that far, of the candidates who are running now, who do you like and why? I mean, I would be interested to hear your take on who you think is the best candidate that the Republicans can put forward in the next election, and why you think they should be the president, and how you think they would fare against whoever ultimately becomes the nominee from the Democratic Party. 800-642-1234. Our All Things Political discussion continues here on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Kathleen Dunn is not in today. She'll be back in her regular spot tomorrow at 1 o'clock. My guest is Yevgeny Fayman. And we're discussing presidential politics at the moment, inviting you to join us. Let's move over to the other side of the aisle. Last week, Hillary Clinton spent 11 hours sparring with Republicans before the Benghazi Committee. That's not its official name, I don't think, but that'll do for now. Leaving aside questions about the legitimacy of the committee's investigation itself, which have been raised by others, what did her performance at the hearing do for her as a candidate?
You know, frankly, I think she was able to show that she can be presidential. I think that on that this last hearing was a win for her, and it kind of backfired on the GOP. So although the previous investigations, I think, definitely hurt her. She wasn't able to weave as coherent a narrative. Here, she was able to be relatively polite. She avoided any serious outbursts. She made clear that, you know, the deaths were extremely tragic, and she feels responsible for the death of Ambassador Stevens. But at the same time, she made it very clear that a lot of these accusations are baseless, and I think it helped her that she had some allies on the committee from the Democrats. But she did better this time around than any time before. I think part of that is whatever training she's receiving from her campaign staffers, to be honest.
Okay, well, let's look at it from the other point of view. Did the committee chair Trey Gowdy's performance, including his use of what was later revealed as a doctored CIA document, do some damage to the credibility of the committee?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, the credibility of this committee, of all these investigations, died a long time ago. I don't think that most of the GOP base pays too much attention to the committee anymore. I think it offers some nice sound bites here and there, but ultimately it's a net negative for the Republicans, and this one in particular, because it's directed at a presidential candidate, I think actually harms the Republican candidate's chances, even if just a little bit.
So is this issue, is the Benghazi issue and the email issue, is that all? Are we done with that now? Can we move on, or are we going to continue to see these?
I think the emails issue will come up in the general. I'm not sure if the Benghazi issue will. That's certainly been beaten to death a little bit more than the issue with the emails. And I think the issue in the emails also is a little bit more legitimate. It illustrates some serious lapse in judgment, whereas in judgment on the part of Hillary Clinton specifically. Whereas what happened with Benghazi, any failures that did happen seem to have been a bigger problem in the State Department rather than specifically with Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
So I expect the emails to come up again. Benghazi probably not so much.
Let's see. We've got some calls lined up. Let's go to the phones, and we'll start in Augusta, where Cheryl is joining us this afternoon. Cheryl, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for taking my call. It appears to me that your guest is very well-spoken and very knowledgeable about all of the candidates, I guess. I would like to go back to a question that you asked much earlier in the interview, and that was about Paul Ryan demanding family time so that he could balance his political life and his family time. And you asked him if that was fair or how he could justify that, since he has voted against bills that would allow the regular voter to do that. And quite honestly, he talked then about health care, and then he worked himself down to minimum wage. And I would like to know specifically how Paul Ryan can justify this. 1, 2, 3 points, nothing but this question. How can he justify this to the public?
Cheryl, thanks. Thanks for the call. Evgeny?
I alluded to this a little bit before, but it's important to separate what one believes personally. So in this case, Paul Ryan's belief that he should have some family time, that he shouldn't devote his entire life to being the speaker, versus what they think the role of policy should be. This really has to do with how much bargaining power you have with your employer. There are people who work in finance who I'm sure would love to have more family time. Would love to spend more time at home, but their work hours don't permit them to do so. Same thing for junior associates at law firms who are fresh out of law school. Just believing that something is good or that you want something shouldn't translate into support for public policy that does so. It's even fair to say, you know, businesses should do this. We're not going to force them, but businesses should consider giving paid family leave or vacation time to their employers. And
Hang on a second, because I want to make sure I'm clear on this. So public policy doesn't have to be consistent with our values?
Well, public policy should be consistent with our values insofar as, whether our values require government involvement in that particular sphere of public policy. So your values might be that family time is important, but that government's role in telling businesses what kind of benefits to offer should be limited. I don't think those two values are diametrically opposed. One of them is a value specifically related to the role of the state, while the other is a value related to how social interactions should function. And I think it's fair to separate the two. There's certainly some intersection, but generally it's not inconsistent to say that the two are different.
Cheryl, thanks so much for the call. We need to take a break. When we come back, I've got a few more questions. We've got some more calls, and you could be one of them at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. You can also reach us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Leave your comment or question there. One of the things, Jenny Fehman, that when we come back, I want to touch on. It's not about the United States, but, of course, Canada had an election, and they made a shift at least a little bit in the direction of the left from the conservative government that they had for some time now with Prime Minister Harper. Now they have a fellow by the name of Trudeau from the Liberal Party. And I'd just like to get your impressions. I'm not asking you to give an expert opinion, but I'd like to just hear if you what the significance may be of that. And maybe we can even speculate, as we often do, on how that might impact U.S.-Canadian relations going forward. All that and your calls yet to come here on the Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's all things political here on the Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munson in for Kathleen today. She will be back tomorrow. My hope is that you'll call us at 800-642-1234 and share your political views. My guest is Yevgeny Fehman, a fellow with and deputy director of the Manhattan Institute's Center for Medical Progress. He writes on healthcare policy, entitlement reform, and the Affordable Care Act. Let's go back to the phones. Mike is with us in Castle Rock. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Getting back to Benghazi, a lot of that information was given to the FBI, and they're going to dribble that out over the next, maybe next year. And I wonder what your comments are on that.
All right. Thanks, Mike. You have Jenny Fehman?
I'm sorry, I had a bit of a hard time hearing part of the question. It was
The Benghazi information, whatever it is that's been generated by the committee is in the hands of the FBI, and they'll probably dribble it out over the next year, according to Mike from Castle Rock.
Okay. I can't imagine that there's going to be anything tremendously new that's discovered there. I think after God knows how many hearings, well over three
yeah.
or four hearings, we've discovered probably all there is. So barring some massive bombshell, whatever the FBI begins to release, however they release it over the next year or two, it's probably not going to affect things too much. Again, I hedge my bets by saying that unless some big bombshell is discovered.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing significant is going to come of it.
We haven't seen a smoking gun.
No.
Let's. I pre-sold this before the break, so I want to make sure we get this in before we go back to the phones again. Canada. They elected a fellow by the name of Trudeau. Well, they elected his party, and he's the leader of it. A little bit of a push to the left on the part of our neighbors to the north. What do you make of that, if anything?
Well, you know, my experience in Canadian politics is a little bit limited, but my sense is that a lot of it has to do with how the Canadian economy has been functioning. It's seen a bit of a slowdown. Government spending as a share of GDP in Canada has slowed down too. Canadian values are a little bit different than American values. So for them, when government spending starts decreasing, you're possibly reducing social services. That's not necessarily seen as a good thing. When it comes to foreign affairs, I think Canada's position has also been important to their voters, especially when it comes to TPP. I know the Liberal coalition has accused supporters of the TPP in Canada of wanting to outsource jobs. They've claimed that they would send something like 20 or 30,000 jobs overseas. I think all those issues together kind of help push voters left. In my mind, I don't get the sense that Canada's political economy has really shifted left. The Canadians have become more liberal necessarily, but that they just wanted something different. And in this case, the Liberal coalition was what was different.
No, it bears watching. Let's see. How about if we go to Mike in Racine next? Mike, hello.
Hi, thank you very much. So in regard to Jeb Bush, given what his brother did, getting us into the Iraq War and that whole Colin Powell in front of United Nations, and I'm not willing to honor the Bush family with another Bush in the White House after, you know, what's been proven to be the lies about the aluminum tube and being prepared to wage war on the part of the Iraq government. And so that's my case against Jeb Bush. Without that, his mannerisms, looking down at the table when he's trying to gather his thoughts and then looking back up, he just doesn't bestow that confidence level as, you know, Trump does. Even Carson, when he's trying to think, he pauses, but he looks straight ahead. I'd tend to vote for Rubio or Carson over either Trump or certainly Bush.
Mike, thanks for the call. Does Jeb Bush suffer from some baggage from his brother's administration?
Absolutely. I think in the general that would probably come back to hurt him. But similarly, I think in the general and possibly even now, Hillary's suffering a little bit from the Clinton name, especially among those who are more progressive and who may not view Bill Clinton's tenure as good and may not view Hillary's tenure as Secretary of State as really advancing American interests or with what they believe to be American interests. I agree. I think Bush definitely suffers in some sense from being affiliated with the Bush name. At the same time, I think it probably also helps him, at least when it comes to winning over some of the mainstream elements of the GOP caucus.
All right, Mike, thanks so much for that call. 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Claire, who joins us from Madison. Claire, hello. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, John. Thank you. If you don't mind switching to state politics for a minute, I was stunned to hear the news today about the latest that the Republican legislature is trying to push through. Where this came from, I'd be interested to hear your guests' views on this. That they want to limit the number of referenda that local jurisdictions can have over raising property taxes or whatever it takes to fund the public schools.
The specific measure would limit the number of referenda and when they could be scheduled by local school boards. And but there's probably a national issue here, as I think Claire discussed a little bit with our call screener, and that is that this is seen as another measure being pushed by an outside group, in this case the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. And so maybe, you know, I don't expect you, Jenny, that you're up to date on all of Wisconsin's internal politics, but there certainly does seem to be some similarity in what Republican legislatures nationwide are advancing as policy initiatives. This might be one more example, and if you could just comment on that for a moment, that'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got outside influence on both sides of the aisle. First of all, you know, among Republicans, ALEC certainly does influence legislation. Chamber of Commerce influences legislation. On the other hand, on the left, you have unions that influence legislation. Some more union focused businesses tend to influence legislation. So it's certainly not a one sided issue. When it comes to specifically referenda, personally, I'm not a big fan of referenda, because it really isn't designed to function with our representative form of democracy. I think with referenda, you run the risk of tyranny of the majority. That being said, there's some trends among Republican states on the type of bills that they're pushing. It's not only bills to limit referenda; it's bills to reform pension liabilities, reform health care for retirees, and part of this just has to do with the fact that Republican states face very similar issues. So it makes sense to me that naturally they'd consider similar strategies for addressing those issues.
Back to the presidential campaign for a moment, and we're starting to get close to the end of the hour here. Both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have recently commented on drug pricing, and we spoke about drug pricing earlier. And both of them have said that they would want, as president, to reel in drug prices. And what do you think of what they've proposed to do?
Well, it depends. I think the idea that you want to limit drug costs for those who are really, really ill and who really are shouldering those drug costs, that's a noble goal, and there's something to it. We sort of do that now. We've already set a limit on out-of-pocket spending for people with private health insurance, and typically insurance companies will also have some deductible once it's met, you're not liable for any more out-of-pocket spending. Now, at the same time, I think the focus on drug costs, drug spending alone is very misguided. It makes up about 10% of our healthcare bill, and it's expected to grow about 0.4 percentage point over the next 10 years. So it makes for nice sound bites, but it doesn't indicate to me that either of them is prepared to seriously discuss what contributes to the country's high healthcare costs. In the case of Bernie Sanders, he's proposed single payer, but I don't think he's acknowledged the need for rationing and for being able to say no that would have to accompany with that kind of system.
Of course, we have rationing in a way now.
We do. We have rationing right now. That does happen among private companies. Typically, the extent to which insurance companies really can just say no is very limited now. They were allowed to do that much more in the 90s, but since then, many states have passed a variety of laws. The feds have passed some laws that limit their ability to do so. And, in our government programs, Medicare, for instance, Medicare isn't allowed to just say no. In fact, Medicare has to cover pretty much every new technology that hits the market. Medicaid is a little bit more limited because it's run at the state level, but even then, the ability of Medicaid to just say no is also very, very limited. So we haven't acknowledged that if we're going to have government-run insurance programs, we have to be able to do that.
We are in the last 30 seconds of the hour here. I just ask you to speculate on what do you think will be the big political news to come out this week? Any guesses?
Well, I'm hoping hoping we see something on the debt ceiling. That's probably going to be the big discussion now in the Beltway. Next week is a deadline, so at the very least, some proposals. I'm expecting that we'll hear something about Paul Ryan's candidacy for the Speaker. Those are the two big ones.
Okay. Yeah, Jenny Fehman, thank you so much for spending this hour with me. I really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We invite you to go online and listen to this hour again. If you missed any part of it, you can go to WPR.org, navigate to the Kathleen Dunn Show page, and listen to the whole thing over again if you'd like. Thanks a lot to KP Whaley for producing this hour and for handling on-air production. Dave Potratz also provided technical assistance. And I'm very appreciative of them as well. Coming up tomorrow at this time, Kathleen is back, and at 1 o'clock she'll be talking to PBS veteran frontline correspondent Martin Smith. That's coming up tomorrow at 1 o'clock. You won't want to miss that. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. Star Wars is next.